Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today on the Soapbox, we have two guests who will be talking about police violence and the systemic use of violence on prisoners. We have two guests today, Robin Anderson and Dylan Avery, so stay tuned and we'll be right back with Robin Anderson. Robin is a professor at Fordham University and her brother Brad is stuck in the system here in California, and I'll let her tell her story. So once again, stay tuned and we'll be right back with Robin. Dr. Robin Anderson, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Oh, it's great to be here, Cindy. Thanks.
Well, I'm having actually a show on police brutality this week, and there's so much to talk about in that issue. I'm also interviewing a filmmaker who's making a documentary called Black and Blue about police brutality. He's interviewing survivors or loved ones of people. So, I end up doing a lot of shows, unfortunately, about this subject.
Right.
So tell me, my listeners and myself, a little bit about you, yourself, your brother, and what is happening right now. And then most of all, I'd like to know how we can help.
Okay. Thanks so much, Cindy. I'm a professor at Fordham University. And I teach in communications and media, and I also for many years have directed the Peace and Justice Studies program. For 12 years I directed it.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was in San Quentin for 34 years. He committed a crime it involved a gun, and when they finally released him after 34 years, what the parole board said was that the amount of time that was normal for his crime was about 11 years. I've long considered him a political prisoner because every governor after the next has always wanted to get tough on crime.
Right.
And that means keeping people inside, as you know, under conditions of quite a lot of brutality. So he got out, and it was kind of very wonderfully blissful to have him out for 6 months, and
mm-hmm.
he was doing well. And he got arrested on a parole violation. They alleged that he had THC in his system.
Uh-huh.
They took him to Santa Rita County Jail. Brad had botched the operation when he was in Quentin, and since then has been on prescribed pain medication. He's on morphine.
Wow.
Pretty heavy dosages.
Mm-hmm.
And he's under doctor's care out. Well, when they arrested him, they threw him into Santa Rita County Jail, where they have a private contractor for health care. And Cindy, here is where we get into police brutality, really.
Mm-hmm.
This is just police brutality on the inside. I might say, before I start telling you Bradley's story in Santa Rita, that in December, Santa Rita County Jail had to pay out $1 million. The sheriff paid $500,000, and Horizon, the private contractor, paid out another $500,000 because of wrongful death inside this jail. So Bradley is in the jail, and they won't give him any of his prescribed pain medication, and he goes into cold turkey
mm-hmm.
withdrawal, and is in terrible pain. And within days, first my niece, then the lawyer I sent in, within 1 week said that he looked like he was on death's door.
Oh,
I talked to a county sheriff one day short of a week he'd been inside, and I said, "Sheriff, you saw him. He's described it on death's door. Do you agree with that?" And he did not disagree with it. And he goes, "Well, we have protocols here." And I said,
"Protocol.
But Sheriff, he went in healthy a week before,
mm-hmm.
and now he's almost dead." So that's where we're at. As of Tuesday, Cindy, I started a social media campaign Because in my mind, these are kind of rogue institutions at this point. They are above mm-hmm. democratic institutions. They are protected by these contracts with the state for health, quote-unquote health care, and they hide behind HIPAA regulations so they can't reveal any information. So I've got lawyers attempting to compel them to give him medical care. I've got his doctor from Oakland calling up, telling him what he needs. And they both tell me they can't do anything about it. The only thing that we can do is call the jail to keep them alive. So I did. On Tuesday, through your networks and others, we started a social media campaign. The jail was inundated with calls. I went in to see Bradley on Wednesday. He had taken a shower for the first time in 3 weeks, mm-hmm. and they had given him his pain medication. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going back today to see if there's any retaliation, to see if they're continuing to give him his medication. So the situation is ongoing with us, the activist public. The only way to force them to not kill him is to be vigilant. And that's a very sad case for American democracy and criminal justice system.
Well, absolutely. You know, and I talk about police brutality, but it is in the prison industrial complex. It's privatized prisons for profit. I've talked to other people who have had these experiences. And, you know, California devotes an extraordinary amount of resources to prisons and jails and things like that. It's crazy, but we don't see the inmates benefiting at all. So where does that money go?
That's right. We don't see the consequences of what's going on inside because the media is simply talking about how, you know, crime, crime, crime. What's so terrible about California policy is that the federal government has now compelled the state of California to lower their prison population because it's so astronomical and overcrowded. Oh, yeah. What Jerry Brown has done is take some of the state prisoners from the state system and push them into municipalities
right.
like the Santa Rita County Jail.
Right.
Well, he didn't give them any money. So they're now being inundated. So they're signing contracts to quote-unquote healthcare, private healthcare providers who aren't, they don't have the funds. The contract is the lowest bidder and they literally don't have medications. So, and then if you're in this kind of terrible, system, a culture of brutality emerges, and there's nothing they can do. They don't tend to help them, so they justify themselves, oh, this is an old lifer, he's been in prison, we're just gonna throw him in the cell and see if he'll survive, and if he doesn't. And when Brad, my brother's name is Lawrence Bradley Bonetto, when he told them how much pain he was in, the jail doctor snickered at him.
Mm-hmm.
In our legal documents, we have that he laughed at Bradley. What's also horrible is they're hiding behind HIPAA regulations while they violate them on a daily basis and saying that they can't release any information to us. So even to know, because they keep saying, we've got a protocol, and they won't tell you what that protocol is. So I've got to get a court order to see what their protocol is. But to me, what their protocol is torture. Because lack of pain, lack of pain medication and then laughing at that pain, that's
right.
The combination of real brutality in my estimation.
Well, and, you know, doctors take an oath, and it's not just, you know, it's not just to profit or whatever, it's for to be compassionate towards your patients, and this is really
right.
awful, but, you know, the thing that gets me is that I don't want to call your brother lucky, but he's fortunate to have someone like you on the outside as his advocate. Most prisoners don't have that.
That's absolutely true, Cindy. All of these guys inside, nobody's advocating for them because many people just aren't up for it, or they don't have the resources, or they don't know. And it's horrible what's happening inside. And you're right. I think Bradley really is lucky, but he's lucky to have an activist community out there, and right. He wouldn't be alive without that activist community.
Just like Mumia. I don't think Mumia would still be alive, or Leonard Peltier, without that support they have on the outside.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, Robin, tell us, my listeners, and I will certainly put it on the newsletter that we send out and the article information about this show, but how can they access more information? I assume there's a Facebook page that they can go to.
Yes, we're starting a Facebook page, and it's called All Kind of Happened Rapidly. But I'm going to have to update you and give you information.
Yes.
For now, in the Santa Rita County Jail, his name is Lawrence Bonetto, and his number is BKB172. The jail number is 925-551-6500. He's coming up for a court hearing on May 9th. I'm hoping that they will continue to stop torturing him until then. It's another week from now. So we will see what happens with the court date, and there are other real issues here that will be ongoing, Cindy, because a person who did 34 years and has already been a political prisoner in the system should not happen to them because they allege they smoke pot. So, many people are saying that people who did such excessive time for crimes that were not worth that time shouldn't even be on parole. So once they get you in the system, it's very dear to them to keep you in the system. They don't like to let people go. And that's there's all kinds of layers to this reform in the criminal justice system that needs to happen to stop this culture of cruelty.
Well, another thing, when you were talking and you were saying that you don't know what the protocol is and about torture, those kinds of things are so deeply ingrained in this empire. It reminded me of, we don't know what the protocol is to get on Obama's kill list.
Right.
You know, so, gosh, it's just so messed up. And I'm happy to talk to you. And, I will post the information you gave me now, because this show's not coming out till Sunday. But I'll post it now, like you said, on social media, and so people can, keep the activism going, because May 9th is a week away. And so we
right.
have to make sure your brother gets his medication and gets the proper care, and that they know on the outside that we're watching them.
That's wonderful, Cindy. That's really great. Thanks so much.
Well, Dr. Robert Anderson, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And please, yes, keep in touch with me over the weekend so we can post updates and things like that.
It was a pleasure to be on, and thanks. Will do.
Okay.
Keep you updated.
All right.
Okay.
Our next guest today on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox is Dylan Avery. Dylan is a young filmmaker, a friend of mine, the creator of the Loose Change films. He is from Oneonta, New York. Dylan Avery, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I should have had you on a long time ago, but how are you doing?
I am doing fantastic, Cindy. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I'm trying to run for governor here in California.
Fantastic.
A month left till elections. Yay. So
I don't support a lot of politicians, but you are one that I will definitely support.
Well, probably because I'm not a politician. I'm an
activist
humanist, and I'm like you. I get up every day and I just think, what can I do today that'll be my best action to make the world a better place? And so running for office is kind of hoping that more people will hear the message than would, otherwise.
Perfect.
Yeah. So, Dylan, many people know you for your film Loose Change, and I know I met you a long time ago when I was out on the road doing stuff, but you have a new project to me that's very timely, very intriguing, and very necessary. You're working on a film called Black and Blue, so can you please tell my listeners about it?
Absolutely. You know, as you just said, I'm currently working on a new documentary, title of which is Black and Blue, and it, you know, it kind of originally started as a, it's actually kind of funny, it started off, sorry, people talking in the background, so I guess I'm going to have to go outside, but it's kind of funny, like, it originally started off, much like Loose Change, as a narrative feature film that I wanted to do. I started writing this script about these three kids who actually kidnap, because, like, a couple of them get screwed over by the police, and they feel so wronged by what had happened to them, and they felt that the officers that arrested them didn't really care for their civil rights or for them as humans, so they figured, well, you know, let's give them a taste of their own medicine. So these three kids actually kidnap a cop and put him in this, like, jail cell that they made, and, I mean, I was working on it for a while, and toying around with the idea, but I never really felt completely satisfied with it. So, you know, I've been following the subject material for a long time. You know, after Oscar Grant happened, you know, I was up at some of the rallies in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
So, like 2009, I was up there at some of those. So, I've had my eyes and ears on the subject for a while now, but it really kind of catalyzed with Kelly Thomas.
Right.
I don't know how familiar your listeners are with the Kelly Thomas case, but essentially, you know, this guy, Kelly, you know, homeless guy, suffers from a variety of mental issues, and I believe actually lives on the street by choice. So it was, I don't remember, it was 2011, I think it was like June or July. I'm unfortunately spacing on the date, and I shouldn't be, but, you know, about 2011, to make a long story short, these five police officers essentially murdered this guy.
Right.
And the only crime he was accused of was supposedly trying to break into cars that were in the parking lot. And, of course, there's no proof of this, and some people, I think, came to the conclusion that maybe the Slide Bar, which is a restaurant nearby that actually called it in, that they actually just called in that just to get Kelly off their property and that he wasn't actually doing anything wrong.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that's just a he said, she said thing, and I don't really know which side of it is true. So, you know, long story short, these cops, you know, they confront Kelly and say, you know, what are you doing, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Kelly doesn't really understand why he's being interrogated, isn't able to comply with the officer's orders. Like, he tells him, stretch out your legs and put your hands on your knees. Well, Kelly kept going back and forth between stretching his legs out and putting his hands on his knees. He couldn't do both at the same time. So, of course, this officer gets angry, starts, you know, making verbal and physical threats towards Kelly, and eventually, and the most troubling thing about this is you can watch the whole thing unfold on YouTube, you know, the entire 35-minute recording, you can watch it all uncut, and that's the scariest part about it, is just watching this situation start out very innocuously and very nonviolently, and it's only when Kelly stands up and tries to walk away, away from the officers, not towards them, you know, doesn't reach for his waistband or any of these other things that these officers always say when they kill someone. Kelly just got up and started to walk away, and so this one cop, it's not Ramos, it's the other one, I think Cincinnati that was on the scene, he just charges up with a baton and just knocks out Kelly's legs, and then before he knows it, there's five police officers on top of him, and, you know, they essentially suffocate this guy, and he, you know, he goes into a coma, and, you know, 4 or 5 days later, you know, he's pulled off life support. So, you know, you fast forward to like January 2014, and the officers are acquitted.
Right.
So I was editing a film out in like Malibu, so I was driving to work every morning. So I was following the case as it unfolded, and I hadn't even heard about it until I started hearing about it on NPR. So, of course, then I went and looked up the case, and, you know, before I knew it, I was listening every morning on the news just to try to figure out what happened and how, you know, I think a lot of people were hoping that these guys were going to get convicted, much like Rodney King. And, of course, you know, much like Rodney King, these guys were let off. And, you know, you didn't see riots like you did with Rodney King, but you did see a lot of rallies, a lot of protests. And I wound up at one of them in February 2014. And while I was there, I was standing, you know, if you ever go to the Facebook Black and Blue page, at least any time in the near future, the cover photo is, it's got protesters on one side, it has police officers on the other side. That's the picture that I took at the Kelly Thomas rally. And right after, like right when I was taking that picture, and you can actually see it in there, the female police officer is looking at me, and she's about to say, you know, you need to get out of the street and back onto the sidewalk. So that happened, and then I'm standing there on the sidewalk as the event is kind of winding down, and there's this guy on the bench next to me, and he kind of looks up at me, and he just notices I was there, so he just struck up a conversation and says, you ever heard of Bobby Henning? And I'm like, no, I wasn't even aware of that. He's like, well, I was the eyewitness. You know, I was there. I saw these cops kill this kid. So, you know, I got his information. I followed up with him, started looking into the case, and it had turned out that I believe the following weekend was the candlelight vigil for the two-year anniversary of Bobby's death. And, of course, his parents were coming down from Auburn, California. So, you know, Kelly Thomas was the first catalyst, and then I met the eyewitness to the Bobby Henning shooting at that rally, and then went to the candlelight vigil for Bobby, and that's when I met Bobby's parents, and that's when I knew that I was about to embark on this journey, so to speak.
I think I actually know them. Is the mom's name Elizabeth?
Yep, Elizabeth, yeah,
yeah.
And Everett.
Yeah, I do know, and it's his stepdad.
Yeah, stepdad.
Right. Yeah, yeah, no, I've met them. I also do as much work as I can with anti-police brutality and then parents of ones who were killed for no reason. And, you know, to me, Dylan, the Kelly Thomas case just, like, broke my heart. it's just, like, so sad. And when you see pictures of him in the hospital, he doesn't even look human anymore. And, you know, to me, the scariest dang thing about this is that it was videotaped, and the cops are often on video brutalizing people, murdering people, and there's just absolutely, I can't say zero accountability because there's a tiny bit, but there's absolutely very little accountability for these horrible crimes.
Yeah, and they're always ruled justified, you know, even in a case like Kelly Thomas, where you have an unarmed man who, as far as we know, wasn't actually committing any crime. And, you know, instead of being able to get his day in court and being able to say, no, you know, I wasn't doing that, or, you know, like, you know, the officers are now, you know, they've all become judge, jury, and executioner right on the spot. And
right.
It would be one thing if they were held accountable, but, you know, like you said, by and large, most of these are ruled justified. They, you know, especially when there's no video, and that, I think, is, you know, the crux of a lot of these cases that we're seeing now, where, you know, the officers will say that a particular thing happened, and they'll stick by that story until the video comes out, and then suddenly they have to backpedal and, you know, say, oh, well, we didn't mean that. You know, it appeared that he may have reached for his waistband. You know, you have cases like Michael Nida, also in Los Angeles County. This is a guy who, you know, was out on a date with his wife, was running across the street to get cigarettes. The police were looking for two robbery suspects. One was a black male. Actually, they were both black males, and one of them was wearing a hoodie. This guy, Michael Nida, is half white, half Puerto Rican, wasn't wearing a hoodie, wasn't doing anything that could have implied that he was taking part in criminal behavior. And yet, you know, the officers chase him down, pat him down, realize he doesn't have a weapon, but then one thing leads to another, and he starts to run because, you know, he's out on a date with his wife. He doesn't want his night to be ruined by some officers who think he might be someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys pat him down. They know he's unarmed. They know he doesn't have a weapon. I think at that point they got to know that they have the wrong guy. But he runs away, and ends up getting shot in the back with a machine gun.
Mm.
And of course, what they say is that, oh, well, you know, he turned towards the officers and he may have reached for his waistband. It's like, first of all, if he was shot in the back, then there's no way that he actually turned towards them. And second of all, you patted him down.
Right.
You knew he was unarmed. You knew you had an unarmed suspect on your hands, and you still shot him in the back with a machine gun. And, you know, Bobby Henning, Michael Nida, Manuel Diaz, you know, all these people who I've met in Los Angeles County, you know, their loved ones were all killed by deputy sheriffs. And so, you know, that's definitely a correlation. And then once I interviewed a lawyer friend of mine and I brought that up to him, you know, he shed some light on the fact that these guys, the deputy sheriffs in L.A. County, they actually spend years within the jail system as guards,
yeah.
And then they're let loose onto the streets to deal with the public.
Not
so
sure.
They're spending day in, day out dealing with rapists, murderers, violent drug offenders, you know, people who, as you know, for the most part, are convicted criminals, you know, convicted actual criminals, I should say. And then they're let loose onto the streets to deal with the public, and that's when you get situations like where an unarmed man is shot in the back with a machine gun because he was running away. I mean, and that's kind of been like one of my, I guess, goals throughout all of this is to try to identify when all this started changing, like when the police officers stopped wearing blue and started wearing black, when they stopped being peace officers and started being police officers,
uh-huh.
You know, when they started taking to protect and serve off of their cars, things like that. You know, there's definitely a disconnect now between the public and the people that are supposed to protect them.
Well, I agree with you about that. And it seems, and I have had many run-ins with the police, and I'm not even comparing myself to, you know, these other tragic things that have happened. You know, because I know that there's always somebody working really hard to get me out of jail, or, you know, I know that my arrests are being filmed and things like that. So, you know, and I'm in for nonviolent civil disobedience and stuff like that. So, but I still have had lots of run-ins with police, and we were on trial one time. And the same thing happened. All the police were lying out of their butts. And then they didn't know we had a film. And so my attorney showed the film. They immediately asked for a recess and came back and started lying.
Sure.
You know, started lying some more about it. But they changed their story, you know, because they saw the film. And at that point, I think the judge should have said, you guys are innocent. Get out of here. But we still had to go to 4 more days of trial. But anyway, I think that the police they don't have to live in their communities anymore, which that used to be true, is I think that they are just another strong arm thugs for the 1%.
Yeah, and that, actually you brought up a point that, I don't know if you know Dave Cahill, my buddy in Jersey. I did a couple of music videos for him, and he does like a lot, like he runs We Are Change's website and a bunch of other things, but he actually brought up exactly that point, is that, you know, the police officers no longer, you know, not by and large, but a good percentage of them, they no longer live in the communities they police, so it's a lot easier for them to look down upon or to view themselves as possibly superior to these people that they don't even have to deal with in their own community. So, and then you get these guys who are out of the army, you know, they come back home and then they join the police office, you know, join the police force, like
uh-huh.
a pretty nasty run-in that I had with Glendale police. You know, the one guy was a, you know, admitted ex-Marine from Arkansas, and he's like, man, I can't wait to get back to Arkansas where the laws are totally different and this and that. It's like, well, then go back to Arkansas. You know, like, you're in Glendale, California. You know, if you want to enforce the laws of Arkansas, then maybe you should go back there and, you know, stop harassing the citizens here in California.
Uh-huh, for sure. So, how long are you into this project? How many interviews have you done? Can you share some interesting
absolutely
information?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing is I'm, because I knew that if I just made a documentary about police brutality, that I would be leaving out a lot of very powerful cases, and I would really be kind of limiting the scope of the film, and I didn't want to do that. So my general motif has been injustice or police brutality. And, you know, on that note, I've interviewed people like George Thompson up in Fall River, Massachusetts, who was arrested for simply filming an officer swearing into his cell phone while doing a construction detail. And, you know, this wasn't like just a passing F-bomb. I mean, this guy was just pacing up and down the sidewalk while he's supposed to be directing traffic, having a very profane personal cell phone call. So, of course, George takes out his cell phone and starts filming him. The cop eventually notices, you know, charges up onto George's porch, breaking his front gate in the process, and, you know, physically restrains and arrests George. You know, George, who told him he had a bad back, and the cop, you know, obviously didn't care, and, you know, said all kinds of messed up things to him that I can't repeat here. So, you know, George gets arrested for violating the Massachusetts Wiretapping Act, which is bogus because that only refers to audio, first of all, and second of all, it only refers to a recording that was done surreptitiously.
Right.
And George is standing there with his cell phone out at arm's length, and the whole reason the officer engaged George is because he saw himself being filmed. So there was nothing surreptitious or wiretap about it.
Right.
The officer just knew that video was going to get him into trouble. So on that note, somehow, while George's phone was in police custody, it was wiped back to factory settings.
Oh,
and
gosh,
of course,
that's so weird.
Yeah, weird. And of course, the chief is like, well, you know, the individual may have logged in through the cloud and done a remote restore. And I mean, first of all, that's bogus because why would George delete the video that would get him off the hook?
Uh-huh.
And second of all, the phone that was confiscated was a prepaid iPhone 3S and had no minutes and had no network connectivity. So the only way that George could have even accessed it remotely is if the evidence vault inside the police department had an open wireless router that George could have possibly connected to his phone with. But all the people that he spoke to at Apple says that that's just not possible. So there's a lot of pressure on the Fall River police chief right now and on Fall River in general to have some accountability and to figure out exactly who was responsible for tampering with this guy's phone. And it was great. You know, I went up there, I interviewed him. We went to a city council meeting, and I filmed him there. It's some pretty good footage. So, you know, that's one case. You know, there's that. I interviewed this one guy real quick in Brooklyn, Sean Randall Thomas, similar circumstances, was filming an arrest and then got arrested himself. This one guy, Dan LaBarbera, I'm mangling his last name right now, he got hassled by the NYPD just for trying to find a home guy. I got Alan Alves up in Cape Cod, who is an ex-Freetown detective who was denied multiple promotions and was even he was the
Dylan,
candidate
I'm losing
because
you again.
He was black.
Dylan.
So,
Dylan, I'm losing you again. You're fading in and out.
Sorry. how much of that did you hear?
I think you went to Brooklyn.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I went to Brooklyn. I interviewed another guy who was filming a police officer. I went to, there was another guy in Dumbo, Brooklyn, that I interviewed who got hassled by the NYPD for trying to feed a homeless guy. I went up to Cape, you know, I was in Cape Cod interviewing George, and while I was there, I not only interviewed this DJ, who got assaulted by a bunch of federal DEA agents because they pretty much didn't like that he was talking to a white girl, and then tried to hit on the white girl, and it didn't go too well, so then they took that out on Dwayne.
Mm-hmm.
And then I interviewed his uncle, Alan Alves, who is a former Freetown detective in Massachusetts, who faced extreme discrimination from his white superiors because he was a black person. And we're talking, like, consistently scoring number one on all the tests, you know, had the most cases. He was, like, the most solid police officer on the force, and yet all the promotions kept going to lesser qualified officers that weren't black, essentially. So I've got all kinds of stuff, and I've only been going at this for, like, a month and a half, and, you know, the places that I've gone, I already know that I'm going to have to go back there because people hear I'm making this movie, and then they talk to their friends, and then their friends refer me to some other people. And it's really just kind of been this domino effect of interviews and the, you know, reach out to me and tell a story, because some of these people, they've taken settlements. Some of these other people, their cases are still ongoing. And in the case of Bobby Hennings' mom and stepdad, you know, they're more than grateful and more than happy to do the interview. I just have to make sure that I don't release any footage until after September, which is fine because the movie isn't coming out anytime soon.
I was like, you're going to have a lot of editing to do on this movie, aren't you? Because there unfortunately is too much. Unfortunately, there's too much information out there.
That's kind of the sad part. At some point, I'm just going to have to stop filming and start editing. But, and that's the other thing is I'm going to have to, like, if something is missing that I need, or if something is just kind of superfluous, and I would just be shooting it just to not put it in the film. So I'm trying to keep so not going kind of cases over and over again. I am trying to have adapters, so certainly going to be multiple versions of the same kind of arrest, but apart from that, I mean, I've really just gone with a very, I guess, open mind, and I haven't really gone into how I want it to happen. I know that there's themes I want to cover, and I know that I want to end on, like, a positive, uplifting note, but I'm going in with a very, very open mind and a very, I'm just trying to see where the film takes me, essentially, and I'm not trying to go into it with any kind of conclusions or anything, and also, I'm not just getting, you know, as you heard, I just have that one ex-cop, but I'm also, this isn't a bad cop film, or this isn't an F the police film, essentially. There are some bad cops out there, but there's also some good cops out there. It just seems that, unfortunately, the scales have kind of tipped and that you're hearing more and more about the bad ones. So, you know, there's this one guy that I'm hoping to interview. He works with law enforcement in Los Angeles, and he does firearms training with the local law enforcement, essentially. And, you know, when I told him about the film, you know, he got slightly nervous because, you know, again, he thought that I was making a film that was just kind of giving the middle finger to the police. But then I elaborated, I was like, no, you know, this is about something much bigger than that. And he says, well, you know, then that is something that I could possibly do, because as someone who works with law enforcement, seeing more and more of these incidents, they really are starting to concern me. And he's the kind of person that I would probably interview about the militarization of the police and how, mm-hmm. you know, the uniforms have changed. You know, you've got federal funds going to local law enforcement, which is pretty much a direct violation of posse comitatus. You know, like Fargo, North Dakota has a tank now. they just have it parked on the town square, you know, just in case something goes down in Fargo, they've got a tank. So, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to be making this film for. I'm really hoping to, you know, hopefully get a good chunk of the shooting done this year, and then, you know, start showing early cuts to people and maybe sending it to a festival here and there.
Uh-huh.
But really the goal right now is just to make a really good film and then see where it goes from there, because without a good film, I don't have anything.
Well, Dylan, have you considered interviewing any Black Panther for this film? Because, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, they were essentially doing the same thing, just like following police so they could be witness. And it kind of went a ways towards, you know, putting a hamper on police violence.
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, if you know any ex-Black Panthers, you think it's willing.
Yeah, historically, they've been putting up with this crap for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So, I do. I do know some, and I will send you contact info for them. So, Dylan, right now, you told me you just have a Facebook page, so can you tell my listeners how to access that? And I will also put a link on the newsletter for this week.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, it's I do have a domain that I bought. I just haven't really had the time to build anything for it. So right now I'm doing all of my posting and communicating through Facebook. So the link for that is simple. It's facebook.com/blackandbluefilm. And the good thing about that is that, you know, social networking has really been a key aspect of this, because I've reached a lot of interviewees, and like a lot of people are reaching out to me through Facebook. So it's really interesting, you know. It's like, you know, when I was making the Loose Change films, I had to track everyone down through phone calls and leaving messages and sending letters and things like that. And, you know, the turnaround on some of these requests is just crazy. Like, I'll send someone a friend request, and then they'll accept, and then I'll send them a message, and then they're like, yeah, sure, here's my number. And, like, within, you know, within 5-10 minutes, I go from, man, I don't know if I'm going to even hear from this person, to, all right, well, cool, I'm going to Boston.
I know, it's and, different, you know, huh?
Yeah, and the other awesome thing about this is that, you know, I don't, because everyone's like, oh, well, you know, you should do a Kickstarter, or you should do an Indiegogo, and thankfully I don't have to do that yet, just because right now it's the cost is pretty cheap. Like, I've just had to rent a camera once in a while, and like right now I'm in Asheville, North Carolina, and the whole reason I'm here is because my girlfriend actually had some family business to take care of in New Jersey, and we're driving back across the country, so of course she offered to, you know, help me shoot my film along the way. So, you know, right now it's all being done through favors, you know, people doing me favors and helping me out and, you know, hey, I can put you up here, I can get you a plane ticket to here. So, you know, right now, knock on wood, it's still a very much an independent film, and I don't have any investors, and I don't have any producers telling me how things should be. I'm just allowed to kind of go out and find my film, which is, you know, really how films should be made in the first place. So,
that's a good thing about the crowdstart or crowd whatever funding things, is it's people giving you $5, $10, $20, you know, they don't necessarily, you know, they're not necessarily involved in telling you what to do, just helping you do it. And I know when I've done a crowdstarter thing or funder, whenever I've done something like that, like for a book, and I just like acknowledge the people in the book that donated to the project. So yeah, I think people would be happy to help you that way if you ever decide to do that.
If I need to, I will. There's really just only two cruxes with that, which is, you know, one, when you do a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo, you have to give people perks. So, you know, you automatically have to start making sure that you get people their T-shirts, their DVDs, etc., which is fine. But the other thing is that, you know, my fan base, I love them, but a lot of them watch my movies for free. So I'm not entirely confident that I could put up a Kickstarter and people start to throw money at it, which, again, is fine.
Yeah.
I'm totally okay with that, you know.
Right.
It's just that knowing the nature of my work and the nature of my past work and the people that follow me, thankfully, right, don't have to do that. And right now it's coming out of the limited amount of money that I do have at my disposal. Because, you know, I was editing a film for someone for like the past year and a half, so I still have some of that I have saved up. So it's all been very inspiring, you know, and like I think that the main reason why I held off on doing this for so long is because I didn't want to do it and, you know, not do a good job, and I also didn't want to do it and just sit and cobble together footage like I did with Loose Change. I wanted to go out, I wanted to meet people, I wanted to get stories that people knew about. I wanted to find stories that people had never heard about, myself included. And I just wanted to explore and just kind of see what was out there. And I really wanted to make sure that I was making something good, you know?
Okay.
So thankfully, I mean, so far, I mean, like you said, I'm going to have a lot of editing to do because there's so much material. And like one of my like motifs that I'm trying to establish, like I was in Boston, we were in the subway, and there were these guys playing on the platform, so I filmed them for a bit. Today in Asheville, there was a guy with a guitar performing by the park, and then I filmed him performing, and then, of course, he had a police story to tell me. So it's been really cool, you know, like, people just kind of open up as soon as they find out, you know, what you're making your movie about. And, like, that one musician that I interviewed, who I told him what the film was about before I interviewed him, the third song that he sang was all about the police and Take the Power Back, and they were all original songs. So it's just, it's really inspiring, you know. It's nice to be on a journey again.
Well, great, Dylan. It does sound really interesting, and keep us posted about it. And if you ever want to come back on the show and talk about anything, let me know, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take you up on that.
Well, Dylan Avery, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And like I said, keep in touch.
Absolutely, Cindy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Well, that's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you learned something, and I hope you were inspired to further action, especially to help Robin Anderson's brother Brad to stay safe in custody and to get out of custody as soon as possible, but also to shed light on this terrible system that does these types of things to people. It's not just about Robin and her cause or her brother Brad Benedetto and what's happening to him, but unfortunately, it's not an isolated incident, as my interview with Dylan Avery also proved. The system is inherently violent, racist, and oppressive. So please support Robin Anderson and Dylan Avery. And I'd like to thank everybody associated with this show. Mikey for booking my guests, helping me book guests occasionally. My production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. Don DeBar, my engineer in connection with CPR Metro, and my guests, Dylan Avery and Robin Anderson, but especially to you for listening and supporting the show. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, or Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.